science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
Yes, I have AUT's Alan Blackman here with me, with joining me and Adam today in the studio. How are you doing today, Alan?
I'm wet.
Yes. Yes, it is a bit shocking out there. People keep on like coming into the office and just like with this very sad look on their faces.
Oh, yes.
And with clothes clearly like soaked through. Not ideal, but I have been safe in the office
It's nice
all
and
morning.
Dry in the studio.
It is,
yeah.
It is.
Yeah, I'll give it that, yes.
It's fun to inspect the rain when you're on the inside of the building. Anyway, first up today, we're chatting about new research that looks at how prehistoric cannibalism wasn't actually very nutritious. Talk us through that.
Yeah, no, this is interesting. You say it's new research, but it's based on old research, and okay, so the guts of it is that they're interested in cannibalism, and so they're trying to find out whether cannibalism was just sort of a ritualistic thing or whether it was done as a nutritional thing. So what the author of this research did, he's at the University of Brighton, he went back to some old papers in the literature where four wonderful people donated their bodies to science, and basically what they did with these four people was to determine their calorific value of their bodies. So essentially they measured the chemical composition of their bodies, and then from that they did some calculations and they worked out the number of calories that would be available if you ate the whole body. So
Like everything,
the lot. Now, I don't know if you read that paper or not, but guess how many humans a single human body could feed for a day and supply their necessary calories.
I did read it, and yeah. I don't remember what it says, but I remember being surprised by it.
Yeah, indeed. 60 people.
Wow.
So you could keep 60 alive for a day.
That's pretty solid.
On the calories that are available in one human body. So the majority of that is fat. So you've got about 50,000 calories worth of fat. The bone marrow, bones and everything. The least is the teeth. You only get about 36 calories out of the teeth.
You'd have to grind them up pretty.
You would indeed, yes. Yes, yeah. So the thing was, okay, so he went back, got these data out of the literature, and then was basically comparing these calorie data with things like your woolly mammoth or your rhinoceros or, you know, other sort of big things that were alive at those times. And your woolly mammoth has got about 3.5 million calories, and your woolly rhinoceros has got about 1.2 million calories, and the poor old human's got about 125,000 calories. So in terms of sustaining people, populations, or whatever, then obviously the human is way down the list in that respect, because its calorific value is so small compared to other bigger, meatier, fattier things.
But and I mean, of course it has less than a woolly mammoth. I mean, it's like, you know, indeed, a fraction of the size.
Indeed. And also it's probably a lot more dangerous to start sort of preying on humans because humans are kind of smart and they'll, you know, they'll prey back, I guess, as it were. So his thesis then becomes that essentially it was too much risk for too little reward, I guess, in terms
So
that's the whole cannibalism thing. So you're not getting that much nutrition out of it. It's a dangerous thing. You're better off hunting bigger prey, which might be less possibly available, maybe, but still going out there and doing that would be a better risk to reward ratio for the humans. So the upshot of it was that basically any sort of cannibalism that's been found over history, he is saying, is due to either it's a ritualistic thing, or perhaps in times of famine or something like that, when there's no prey around, then you resort to your neighbour, as it were.
Right, I see. So it was never sort of a staple of people's diets because of its health benefits?
Seemingly not. No, no.
So, thank goodness for that, eh?
We've all learned something today, I think. The original papers are quite interesting too, the way that they prepare the bodies do all this measuring of their calorific values, and you know they chop them up with a stainless steel knife. They specified stainless steel.
I've got some really morbid images in my head of them just poking up a human leg steak. Yeah.
Yes, we shouldn't laugh, but yeah.
So, shall we move on?
Yes.
Okay, so the next story today is yet another sad case of poor cancer sufferers desperate for any measures to cure themselves, and this is them being exploited by awful people.
Amen. Okay, so this has been in the news over the last week, and basically a lot of it comes back to dear old Sir Colin Meads, wonderful rugby player and as he was, who unfortunately has pancreatic cancer. And last year it was sort of reported in the news media that he was taking this stuff called Tikiri Gold, and that this was going to cure him of cancer, and he was really optimistic, really upbeat, etc., etc. And then it sort of resurfaced last week in the news, and again with the Colin Meads reference. And so sadly, he's come out and said that no, it hasn't actually helped him. He's still taking it, but it hasn't cured him. And that sort of led to, I guess, a little bit of an investigation of what this stuff actually is. And it's snake oil, basically, not to put too fine a point on it. A thing called electrolyzed water. And so what they say is that you pass an electric current through water and you generate the stuff called hypochlorous acid, providing you've got some salt in your water. So if you take seawater and electrolyze it, you'll get this thing called hypochlorous acid. And that is very strongly related to a thing called bleach, which is, for those of you chemists out there, the conjugate base of hypochlorous acid, sodium hypochlorite, which is just bleach. And so they're selling.
So people are drinking watered down bleach.
They are. And they're selling this stuff for $100 a bottle, $100 for 2 litres, I believe. They're recommending that you drink 600 mils a day for 8 weeks, something like that. They're making a fortune out of it. This is all done by a quote-unquote organic farmer in Taranaki, who is backed by a GP in Hawera. And the quote, from their website, is that Tikiri Gold is an organic liquid manufactured from the same ingredients and in a similar manner to the way that your body creates your immune system components. So there are people that don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Right, so that's like a crock of shit, basically.
It is. And then they also have, of course, the out on their website saying that any medical benefits claimed are not claimed by us, they're just claimed by the users, and they've got, you know how it goes. It's the same old thing, and it happens again and again and again, and they are preying on the vulnerable and the people who are just at the lowest point of their lives, and it's just despicable.
Totally.
It really is. They say they're undergoing a clinical trial, but it's not a clinical trial in the true sense of clinical trial. It's not double-blind placebo, all of that sort of stuff, which it should be. But it's, they're just terrible, terrible people. Just awful people. And then, of course, when you raise the thing about the, or somebody raised the thing about the clinical trial, and the guy said, oh, no, Big Pharma want clinical trials because they're all just about making money, and all of this utter nonsense. And, you know, you have a look at their Facebook page. They've got 670-odd members on their Facebook page, and you just want to get on there and just say, look, please, people, don't fall for this stuff. It's not going to help you. And there's, again, one woman on the website who delayed a mastectomy because...
she was giving this a go.
Yes, yeah. And, yeah, it makes you weep. It really does. Why these things are so prevalent is just beyond me. I don't know. I don't know. But I guess people at that stage of life would try anything.
And so I also read in the article that I think the Ministry of Health said that they weren't planning on investigating it.
Well, I mean, if they investigate this, they've got to investigate all of the bloody snake oil merchants out there, of which there are many. This is very, very similar to a thing called Miracle Mineral Substance, which made the news a few years ago, sort of big in Australia. Pretty much the same stuff, same modus operandi, and maybe. You know, maybe we should be teaching more science in schools or something like this. Maybe we should teach these as case studies in high schools and just bring people's attention to all of this. Why are people so distrustful of so-called mainstream medicine? I mean, there is no other medicine than mainstream. There's no such thing as alternative medicine. There's medicine and there's not.
Mm.
So why do people distrust medicine so much? I don't understand that.
Right. I guess it's like if you don't have that particular knowledge and something is presented to you and it's packaged in a way that makes it sound feel legitimate, then it's like how are you to really know unless you have that particular knowledge, I suppose.
I know. And maybe we should just be training our kids to maybe ask questions, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that, yeah, that goes across the board. I mean, in general with, like, just media, critical media literacy, right? That to just be like, hang on a second.
Yeah, where's your proof? Mm. You know, show me your proof.
Absolutely.
Mm. Yeah.
And so our final story today, we're talking about chemical weapons. Can you give me a rundown of where these came from and, yeah, the uses?
I can. So, of course, the horrendous events in Syria of last week sort of prompted me to have a talk about this. And being a chemist, obviously, I'd like to think I know a little bit about chemical weapons. So they started probably further or longer ago than a lot of people think. So you can trace them back to around 9th century China, the first chemical weapons. And they then sort of migrated along the Silk Road and they ended up in Europe in around about the 14th century. So what we would recognisably call today chemical weapons. So that's, you know, that's a good sort of 600, 700 years of Western use of these chemical weapons. And it basically revolutionized warfare because obviously now you've got the ability to not have to engage in sort of hand-to-hand fighting, that you can sort of lob projectiles at your enemy and these projectiles will destroy your enemies. So, and it all goes back to, as I say, 9th century China and in particular a chemical called potassium nitrate, otherwise known as saltpeter. And that there were huge deposits of this in China, and the Chinese found out if you mix this with particular other chemicals, then you've got your chemical weapons. And in terms of these chemical weapons, they rely on a particular chemical reaction that's called oxidation. And what that does is essentially it turns a solid into a gas very, very, very rapidly and allows you to, again, as I say, hurl projectiles at your enemies. So so the name of that chemical weapon that the Chinese came up with was a thing called gunpowder. And perhaps people might be a bit surprised by that because you wouldn't classify gunpowder as being a chemical weapon. But it is. Anything where you're shooting a projectile at somebody else is a chemical weapon. It's all based on chemistry. Okay?
Right. And I'd never kind of thought about it in that sort of way.
Yeah, and not a lot of people have. Okay, so you're relying on chemistry to shoot somebody.
Right, and relying on that that reaction
to happen
as a weapon.
And that's how all guns, mortars, howitzers, whatever, work, okay, on the basis of that. Now, people generally sort of date first chemical weapons to the First World War, when they were first used by the Germans and then retaliated by the English. But I guess my point is that this civil war's been going on in Syria for, oh my goodness, how many, 7 years now, there or thereabouts? And we've had one side or the other side of where we're bombing civilian neighbourhoods with so-called conventional weapons. And there's a little bit of outrage expressed, but nothing gets done. But as soon as you put a little sarin gas in one of those projectiles and drop it on a civilian neighborhood, then for some reason the world gets on its moral high horse and threatens war, basically, because of the fact that they've got this little bit of so-called chemical weapon in it. Who feels more pain? Somebody who's been sort of had shrapnel go through them or somebody who's inhaled a chemical weapon? What's the difference? They're both going to end up dead.
Is that because the sarin gas attack had a bigger effect, though? Is it because it killed more people instead of...
Not necessarily. I mean, you know, you just drop bombs on civilian neighbourhoods. I mean, look at Mosul at the moment. They're fighting for that. And, you know, there's this terrible civilian casualties there. And, you know, that's not chemical weapons. And Mosul's a great example, because 6 or so months ago at least, we were promised that the Iraqi army were just going to overrun the place, and you know, and ISIS were going to be kicked out of there. And then all of a sudden everything went suspiciously quiet in the media, and you never heard about Mosul until maybe a month or so ago. And you know, it's hand-to-hand fighting and everything. No chemical weapons there. People are just dying because of grenades and bombs and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. I don't see any difference personally. We should be equally outraged at this.
So why do you think there is this distinction in the way that it's treated by world leaders and the media?
It's a really good question.
I'm curious, as maybe it's because a chemical weapon such as sarin gas can be seen as indiscriminate as to who it targets. So you can target a bomb. Obviously, if you're targeting civilians, it's still a terrible thing.
Yeah.
But what can happen is if you just drop a gas in the middle of a neighborhood, it doesn't really care where it goes. It just sort of goes everywhere.
Yeah.
Maybe that might be a bit of the reason.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, things like napalm and stuff like that. You know, do you classify those? Or phosphorus bombs, are they classified as being chemical weapons?
Yeah.
You know, they're relatively indiscriminate, and you know, they're horrible things. I just think, you know, I hate to say it, but I think last week there was a bit of faux outrage. I think we need to be outraged by any civilian deaths, by any use of any weapons at all. Okay, so call me naive or whatever, but you know, these weapons are chemical weapons. All weapons are chemical weapons, basically. So let's not distinguish between them. Let's not be raised to action by these so-called chemical weapons, these sarin gases and everything. Let's be raised to action as soon as the first shot's fired.
Absolutely. Well, on that kind of dark note.
Sorry.
It's been a terribly dark Dear Science today.
Blame the weather.
Yeah. It's all the weather's fault. Alrighty. Well, we'll talk to you again next week, Alan. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jimena.
See you later, Alan.
See ya.
That was Dear Science.